I'd like to call the Military Affairs Division to order, and would Vice Chair Bliss please lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Again, committee, welcome. Our first committee meeting where we're going to be hearing bills. We got a pretty full house here today. We got five bills, plus we're going to be listening to an overview from the American Legion and also from the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And do we have a motion to approve the minutes from January 9th meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All in favor?
Aye.
So moved. First bill on the agenda is House File 321. And I will move House File 321 to be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Representative Lean, welcome to the committee. Your bill is before us, and please tell us about your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate your time and attention today to this bill, House File 321. And the bill seeks to exempt vehicle fees and taxes for 100% service-related disabled veterans. The concept of the bill was brought to me by a constituent, and I agreed with him that the policies set forth in this bill would be good public policy to give back to those who have given our country so much. I have asked for a fiscal note on the bill. However, a completed fiscal note has not been presented to me. And now I will walk through the different sections of the bill. Section 1 establishes the policy for vehicles registered by 100% service-related disabled vets, and this is as determined by the rating system set up by the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. Section 2 establishes the vehicle types and exemptions given under the policy for vehicle registrations and license plates. Section 3 applies to the policy for titles for vehicles registered by 100% service-related disabled vets. Section 4 connects the definition in state law of 100% service-related disabled veterans to the policy. And again, this definition is set forth and determined by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Section 5 establishes the bill's policies for driver's licenses and state-issued ID cards, also for state-issued senior ID cards. And Section 6 of the bill applies the policy to sales taxes on vehicles bought by a 100% service-related disabled veteran.
Any questions from the committee? Yes. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward. I'm just wondering how many veterans do we have that would qualify for this in Minnesota right now?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. I do not have that information. I assume that would be in the fiscal note that I have requested. I just haven't heard back yet from Department of Transportation about that number. I should say, though, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, that I did draft this bill last session, and the estimated cost would be between $2 and $3 million. I believe that was per year for the bill. So,
Is there somebody from the department, Mr. Johnson? Do you have those numbers? Pardon? Doesn't have it? Normally, Mr. Johnson's got all the numbers for us. So.
Chair Detmer, members of the committee, Ben Johnson, Legislative Director with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and unfortunately I don't have that number memorized. I can get it for the committee, and we'll do so this afternoon if that will be all right, sir.
That'll be fine. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there, some members of the committee not be familiar, including myself for that matter, of what you have to do to, when you get for a med board or... But I know a bunch of folks who have 100% service-related disabilities through aggregation when you'd never be able to tell. And so some of our members may have constituents who qualify for this, but you would have no idea even by looking at them. Can you give committee members just a brief understanding of what it takes to get to 100% service-related disability?
Mr. Johnson?
Chair, Representative, I actually cannot give you an overview of the process for getting to the federal 100% service-connected. As you described, the aggregate is a brief overview would be that you could have multiple disabilities that cumulatively reach 100%, so 10% for hearing loss, 10% for some other forms of disability, loss of a limb or traumatic brain injury, that cumulatively each percentage would aggregate to 100%, but I'm not conversant in the process for the federal benefits. I apologize.
And Mr. Johnson, you could probably get that information to us and just get it to the committee, because that was a good question, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I think the only injury I have was when a fellow private was trying to fireman carry me in basic and dropped me on my head, and I broke my finger.
So that's 100%?
I got an LOD for that. It could be 100%, Mr. Chair, because I point at people a lot. So I need this finger for a lot of things.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, it does look like a member from the audience may have additional information about that question.
Okay, if they would come forward and please give us your name for the record. And
Randy Tisdall, State Adjutant of Minnesota's American Legion. I previously served as a Department Service Officer helping veterans find the way through the maze to their benefits. And Mr. Chairman, to Representative's question, in layman's terms, it's a long explanation, but it kind of goes like this. I want to start out first by talking about 100%. There's 100%ers that are temporary, meaning they have a future exam somewhere out there by the federal VA that may take that 100% away from them. Let's say they had a surgery and they're disabilitated because of that surgery that's service-connected and they can't go until they go through all of the follow-up. So that could be a temporary 100%, different from total and permanent. Total and permanent is when you have no future exams. There's two types of 100%ers. There's those that are there because of their inability to hold gainful employment. That's IU, individual unemployability, 100%. They only need to be a cumulative of 60 or 70 on an individual rating in order to apply for the IU, individual unemployability, which requires a VA doctor's note and VA certification that you cannot hold gainful employment. And that's got to be proven through an interview process. Straight up front, the 100%ers, total and permanent, that number isn't very large really in Minnesota, and the department will get you that, I'm sure. I've heard the department talk about it in the past. Deputy Commissioner of Benefits and Services knows those numbers, and I'm sure that Mr. Johnson will get those from him. But your total and permanent, just as he said, is accumulation of. It's not simply a matter of adding a 50% and a 50%, saying, okay, they're 100%, they don't need any further exams, they're 100% T&P. It don't work like that. There's a formula that the VA uses. So they start out with the highest percentages. I'll use myself, for example. I'm 50% for two different items, so those two things are added together, and then the 40s, then the 30s, and the 20s, and it's based on the full ability of the person. And I will defer to the federal VA to really explain their formula, but it isn't as simple as a 50 and a 50 equals 100. I'm at 100%. I'm a good example that you used. First can walk about. If you add all my individual numbers up, I'm around 210% disabled, but I only add up to 110% by the VA standards. So I'm 100% total and permanent, based on their charts. And if you Google the VA, there is a compensation chart that helps you understand better how to add those disability ratings up, the individuals, to come to a total. But I urge you to think about in this bill, the bill in the format of total and permanent, and not just percenters. 100% total and permanent. That way they don't need any future exams. There's no chance that they'll come back and say, oh, this veteran really has been reevaluated. We're going to drop him to a 90 or a 70. Mr. Chair, Representative, does that answer the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? We've got Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, can you tell me, there's a lot of different areas of where there would be exceptions here in the different taxes and fees. Is there some type of way to kind of weed through this to where it would be, is there an identification card or, you know, so one of the examples, let's say motor vehicle sales tax, when you go to buy a motor vehicle, you fill out the paperwork. How will the people know processing that paperwork, let's say at the dealership, to give you that deduction? Or when you go to pay your registration or certain different areas, is there going to be some type of, is there an ID or some type to kind of minimize the everything, pooling it all together and a lot of the paperwork, like one-stop information, if you understand what I'm saying?
Representative Lean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Frankie. I assume the Department of Transportation or the Department of Public Safety through the Department of Motor Vehicles would establish some sort of framework for this. I know when you go in and get your driver's license, for example, you have a box to check for organ donors or, you know, a medical alert box, something like that. So I assume there would be some sort of framework to be worked out where once a veteran is established as being 100% total service-related disabled, that designation they could then present to the DMV when they get their license, their tabs, their license plates that would say, you know, these fees, these taxes are exempt.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Mr. Chair, I was just trying to think of a way to make it easier on the veterans to obtain all these benefits without having to muddle through a bunch of paperwork. So that seems like a feasible.
Yeah. Representative Frankie and also Representative Lean, I think this is probably some, you might want to get some background on this because your bill will be going to the transportation finance. So I'm sure that will be a question that will be brought up. So.
Yes, absolutely. And Mr. Chair and Representative Frankie, I do agree. We do need to have some sort of designation. And again, I assume this would be fairly easy to administer. You know, if the department agrees this bill overall, this policy overall would be good to set up. I assume there would be a pretty easy framework for the various DMVs to administer for this. But, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. And any other questions? Yes. Would you approach the mic and please introduce yourself?
Tom Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. One, I'd like to speak in support of it, but just a comment. But also, I think I can give you a little bit of information on that that might help. There's 361,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. There's 91,000 disabled veterans, and 100% disabled generally runs about 10, 11% of that. So it's roughly in the neighborhood of 9,000 is the number 100% disabled. And also as far as documentation, if you're a disabled veteran, you have, first of all, an ID card, but you also have available federally, and you can get it online and print it out so you can bring it out. It's a pretty easy thing that'll bring out what are your disabilities, what your percentage is, and it's a federal document that can be generated quickly online if you have access to it. And so I think the process, the mechanisms are in place to fairly easily administer them without an additional burden. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lean, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, members, again, I appreciate your time and attention to this bill, House File 321. And like I said, I think this would be a good way to give back to those who have given so much to us. So, again, thank you.
Well, the chair renews the motion that House File 321 will be referred to the Committee of Transportation Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The next bill on the agenda is House File 127, which is my bill, so I'm going to turn it over the gavel to Vice Chair Bliss, and please take the gavel, Vice Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Detmer, would you like to move your bill before the committee
that
it be referred to the State Government Finance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 127 and be referred to the State Government Finance.
Is there any discussion? Oh, your bill is in force. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Vice Mr. Chair. See, when you got the gavel, you're the chair now, not vice chair. What the bill does, it provides funding for the Twin Cities Public Television to help cover the and share the cost of production on project related to the Vietnam War. And the fiscal impact it approximates is about $950,000. These are like matching funds that we're talking about from the general fund to the Department Administration for the grant of Twin Cities Public Television. And I have two people here that are going to be testifying, and I would like to first introduce Bill Straczynski. He's friends of the Minnesota Public Television, and also Jim Polagarity, president of the CEO of Twin Cities Public Television. And they would like to talk about this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Bill Straczynski with Friends of the Minnesota Public Television Association, an organization that I've represented for 35 years here at the state capitol. This is an important project in our history and in our legacy of veterans in Minnesota. And Mr. Paglierini will take you through the details of the project itself. I just want to tell you that this is an initiative that's brought forward by all the public television stations in Minnesota, and they're located in Appleton, Granite Falls area, Austin, Minnesota, Bemidji, Brainerd, and certainly Duluth, Minnesota, the Twin Cities, and of course Moorhead, Fargo area. Every citizen gets a public TV signal, and every one of your stations locally, and you know who they are, will be involved in this particular initiative, particularly in the outreach and the documentary production phase of it. 1968 certainly is 50 years of the buildup of the height of the Vietnam War. I'm a Vietnam veteran myself, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this legislation, certainly, and support this legislation just from being a veteran's perspective and to have a chance to tell our stories like we've never had a chance before. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim Paglierini, who is the CEO of Twin Cities Public Television. This station is leading the charge in this particular initiative, so thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Representative Dittmer. I am Jim Paglierini, the president of Twin Cities PBS, and it's a position that I've held now for about 20 years. So my thanks to everyone on the committee, the chair of the committee, and the members of the committee who've sponsored this bill. And as Bill indicated, although I am the president of Twin Cities PBS, I'm really here representing all of the Minnesota public television stations, as he indicated. We're unique in some ways in that I think this state is blessed with six independent public television stations that are owned and operated by the communities in which they serve. So this legislation and this project is going to reach out to every corner of the state. Also, just want to take a moment to acknowledge a couple of people in the audience here. We have Les Heen from Pioneer Public Television and Lee Freeman, who is a member of our community advisory board. He's going to be one of our advisors on this project. And right now, Lee is heading up an organization called The Mission Continues. Lee himself, of course, is a Vietnam veteran and has been a great help to us as we started to develop this idea a couple of months ago. So it really was, a few months ago I went to Bill Straczynski and I said, I think we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to recognize, thank, and give voice to the over 100,000 Vietnam veterans in Minnesota. And that's because in the fall of this year, 2017, PBS is going to be broadcasting an epic documentary on Vietnam, 18 and a half hours, produced by none other than Ken Burns. And you know it will capture the attention of the nation. It's going to awaken memories, some of them good, but most of them painful and ambivalent for many of us who have lived through that era. And what I also think is quite interesting, it's going to introduce the younger generation to a war and to a veteran's experience that is quite different than the kind of experience our veterans have today coming home from service. So because of the attention that this series is going to get, I think we have an opportunity to do something meaningful, memorable, and lasting here in Minnesota to honor our veterans. As you all know, the Vietnam War was the most divisive conflict in this in American history next to the Civil War. And it was often expressed as a division between veterans and non-veterans. In Minnesota and across the country, many vets were shamed upon their return from Vietnam. And even 50 years later, there are still open wounds that need healing. But it's only by hearing each other's stories that we can truly gain a deeper understanding about the Vietnam War, its impact on an entire generation, and we can learn lessons for today. This is, as I said, a big project and a big vision, which I'll explain in just a moment. But we feel it's one that's going to have lasting impact in Minnesota and beyond. Totally costed out, we're ready to invest close to $2 million into this year-long initiative. We're asking the state to make a commitment to fund about half of that. And once committed, we will guarantee that the other half of the funds will come from our existing budgets and also from funds that we're in the process of raising from the private sector. But we have to move quickly in order to really achieve the vision of this work. So our year-long project has four components. The first, as I said, is to take advantage of the attention and the literally millions of people in Minnesota who are going to be watching the Ken Burns series. So one element of this project is we're going to deploy video production crews throughout the state to capture video shorts and stories about Minnesota veterans' experience and the experience of Minnesota during the Vietnam War. And they'll be broadcast adjacent to and along with the Ken Burns series. The second component, and a project we're already investing money in, is going to tell the story of the secret war. So Minnesota's Vietnam veterans include, as you know, many Hmong refugees who fought the secret war in Laos. And through the documentary, we're going to underscore the reality that the secret war, which was not acknowledged by the CIA until 1994, was and is an integral part of the history of Vietnam. Ken Burns, interestingly enough, is not going to tell that story. As you know, Minnesota is home to some 70,000 Hmong. And the service of Minnesota Hmong's veterans was recognized with a public memorial at the state capitol in 2016. We in public television have a great relationship with the Hmong community and a trusted relationship. And I think we have a brief moment in time to capture the firsthand stories of the elders who fought in the war, the stories of their flight from their home and their resettlement in this country. And this documentary is going to be shared with public television stations all across America. The third component will be a fascinating project where we'll identify a few veterans and take their stories and memories and actually write a theatrical play about it. There's a group that we're going to be working with called the Telling Project who uses theater to help people understand and experience the experiences of veterans. So we will document the production and the creation of this theatrical play, and then we'll also be putting on the play at several venues across the state of Minnesota. The fourth component, and the one that I think I'm very excited about, that has the great potential to engage literally thousands of people, will be the creation of what we're calling a digital story wall. So this is going to be a lasting memorial, a place that invites the sharing and the exploration of personal memories through videos, portraits, narratives, snapshots, and interviews of Minnesotans who fought in Vietnam and those whose lives were changed at home. Our vision is to engage schools, libraries, community centers, veterans organizations to work with us to collect the stories from all across Minnesota. And the final component that we're envisioning of Vietnam Minnesota Remembers is to have the project culminate a little over a year from now here at the state capitol with a day when we will honor and celebrate the service of Minnesota's Vietnam veterans. As I said, we've already committed funding for this project, and we're willing to commit more. We're brainstorming all kinds of ideas on how we might make this happen. But in all of the conversations that I have had with veterans, I have been reminded it's not going to be easy. We know very well that most veterans have remained silent for years, choosing not to open the wounds, and relive a period of their lives that was painful. But we think the time is right, and this must be done now. The average age of a veteran who served in Vietnam is 68, and hundreds of them are passing away every year. This Ken Burns series is going to have all of America talking about the war. It's going to stimulate questions and awaken memories. And this project is about having a safe place and a way here in Minnesota for those questions to be answered and discussed, for the stories to be told before they're lost, and finally, to honor and thank Minnesotans, Vietnam veterans, for their service. So we're very grateful for your consideration of this funding and hope we have an opportunity to work with you all in making this a reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pagliarini. Is there any discussion? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Detmer, thank you for this bill. It's a great project, and I really, really want to see it get funded. My concern is that it's going to state government finance, and last session it had a negative target. Have you given it any thought to, or is there another bill you have moving, going to legacy, where it might have a greater chance of being funded?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, back when I was approached on this funding mechanism, that's one of the first questions was legacy, and I would like to maybe have my testifiers address that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenthal, again, thank you, Chair Detmer, and for your authorship of this particular bill. I've had a number of conversations with different members of the legislature, and certainly some in leadership positions, and the thought is that this bill is above and beyond the normal type of legacy projects that we do in public television. We'll be testifying there in about 10 minutes in that committee for other funding sources. So we look to the general fund for support for this particular initiative because it's once in a, well, in this case, 50 years opportunity to do that, and we're just hopeful. We have a wonderful group of authors on this bill. We're hopeful that the general fund will support it and move it rather quickly. And that's why we're so pleased to have this hearing today. So we're hopeful that we can get things along actually in February or March for sure. At latest passage would be very beneficial because things are in production, and we need to know if the money is available or not in order to meet the deadlines we have for rolling this out with the Ken Burns Initiative. So.
Representative Rosenthal, follow up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope that you get the funding because it's a really great project.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, you know, yes, that was, and Representative Rosenthal, that was my first question when they came into my office, and so this is something that we need to, hopefully we can act on it pretty quickly. Any other questions?
Representative Davids?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Rosenthal brings up a very, very good point. And I, of course, would defer to the Chairman Detmer, but is there some way maybe to two-track it, go to state government finance and be put in a bill to send over to legacy or something? Because I think your chances in legacy would be better. But, of course, I would defer to the Chair, but Representative Rosenthal, your point's well taken, that might have better luck over at legacy than state government finance. Just a thought.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we can always do a double track. And I guess I can have my research put together another piece of legislation to double track it just to make sure we're covered. So, but hopefully we can get it through just the way it's written.
Follow up, Dave? Representative Davids? No. Are there any further questions? Are there any other testifiers? Any further discussion? All right, and Representative Detmer, would you like to close?
Just closing comments. Again, thank you for bringing this, for allowing me to bring this bill before the committee. And I'd like to renew my motion that House File 127 be referred to the state government finance.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 119. Representative Detmer, would you like to move your bill before the committee and have it be referred to the Committee on Taxes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 119 and be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Chair Detmer, your bill is before us. I understand you also have an author's amendment labeled A1 to get your bill in the form the author wants. Does everybody have a copy of the amendment? Representative Detmer, please tell us about your amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment, again, wants to get the bill in the framework that I would like to see it in. We had some concerns about the pushback and the cost, so that's what my amendment will do, is just take it back to 2012. that certain part of the piece of legislation.
Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Detmer, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The disabled veterans currently receive a property tax exclusion that varies based on their level of disability. And currently, a surviving spouse continues to receive that exclusion for about eight years after the death of a disabled veteran, providing that they don't move out of the home, the property, or they do not remarry. This bill would extend the surviving spouse house exclusion to make it permanent as long as the spouse does not move or remarries. Now, if you look back about 8 years ago, the exclusion was for about 2 years. Then the legislature, we moved it to 5 years, and then 2 years ago, we moved it to 8 years. So I'm a legislator that likes to take baby steps, and hopefully we can get it indefinite now for the surviving spouse. And this bill would provide this benefit for more surviving spouses for a longer period of time. Many times these surviving spouses have taken care of their veterans over the years and maybe were not able to work because of the care that they had to do inside their home. So, and also the bill would also add a new way for a surviving spouse to receive the exclusion if a 100% service-connected disability veteran dies without receiving the benefit. The surviving spouse could still apply for the exclusion within 2 years after the veteran's death. Now, this wasn't part of the bill that I had last year that was in the tax bill. This was brought to me by the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, and because there are surviving spouses that are falling through the crack. So with me today, I have Trent Dilks, and Ralph Donais would like to address the bill.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Trent Dilks. I'm the legislative chair for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Minnesota. Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair, members. So what we're trying to address with this is I'll tell the committee a little story. In August, I sat down with a Vietnam veteran who had just been diagnosed with multiple forms of aggressive cancer. I had never used the VA before. He wasn't service-connected at the time. Sat down at his kitchen table with him and his wife, and we filed a claim on the cancer. All of them were presumptive to his service in Vietnam and his exposure to Agent Orange. VA moves very quickly, and in 4 days, we had him 100% permanent in total for three various forms of cancer. They weren't sure which one was going to be the cause of death. Unfortunately, in October, that veteran passed away. And under the current law, what that means is he died too quickly for his surviving spouse, his widow in this case, to receive the property tax value exclusion as currently in the law. Right now, he would have had to have lived, instead of for 3 months, for 16 months due to the time frame. Application due by July. And then further, they've recently ruled that they have to live into that taxable year. So he would have to live into the tax assessment year of, we're talking now, 2018. For a veteran who passed away this past October. It wasn't going to happen. So that's kind of the driving force and why I approached Representative Detmer with this change in the law. Essentially, his widow right now is not receiving that benefit, and there's no way for us to get him under the current law that benefit. When I sit down with a veteran like that, and I do quite a few of these with terminally ill veterans, their number one concern is not them, and it's not resentment that they're going to pass away from an illness caused by their service. It is their spouse. It's the survivor. And that's what they want to hear about. That's what they want to know. What can I do once they do pass away? And what can happen for their spouse? So this helps with that. As Representative Dadamir said, it does three things. It creates an eligibility for a widow to apply for the first time. The problem with the current law is that widow cannot submit the first application, and the veteran, even if he would have submitted it before he passed away and became too ill, it would not have been processed because he didn't live into the next taxable tax assessment year. It gets rid of the eight-year limit. It gets rid of that ticking clock. We're losing. Essentially, this is for mostly for our Vietnam veterans. We're losing our Vietnam veterans to Agent Orange illnesses at an alarming rate. Gets rid of that eight-year clock. It's not ticking. And the last thing is, it does add a benefit for surviving spouses that are receiving DIC. And what that means is, if you die as a direct result of your service, that's how your widow or widower becomes eligible for DIC. So what we're saying with that is, if a veteran dies directly as a result of their service to this country, we want their surviving spouse protected. HF 119 does that. And then with the as amended, I know I get questions about the cost. We're talking as amended, it should be less than 1/100 of 1% of any county's income from property tax. So it's a pretty low impact as far as what the county's funding should get. So that's the DAV, and we support this HF 119. Thank you.
Representative Dave, do you have some questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Detmer, the widow that the testifier alluded to, I'm sure there's more than one, what would it take to write your language such that we could go back a sufficient amount of time to fix some of those folks up?
Mr. Chair, and Chair Davis, the current language will do that for her.
Oh, the current language would pick it up.
Yes, it will.
Oh, cool. Okay. Item two, have you talked to the counties, Mr. Chairman, on what their approach would be on the cost? Because they're actually going to be shouldering the cost of this.
That's correct.
Have you been talking to the counties?
The county hasn't come to me yet. I know it's been the bill has been out there, so... This bill was in the tax bill last year, so there was some slight changes, which doesn't really put an extra burden on the county that much. So I'm sure when it comes to the tax committee, they'll be there. So,
Representative Bates, do you have any further follow-up?
Thanks.
And the next testifier, please state your name for the record.
My name is Ralph Donay. I'm chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota. I had the honor of working on this bill many years ago in another form when Representative Severson probably first initiated it. He has since moved to Florida and dumped us. I don't know why, but I got to get on Dan about that. But what this bill does today is correct some of those things that back when we first came up with the bill and said, this is a good idea, this should happen in Minnesota, weren't thought of at the time. So this is one of those tweaks that needs to be done so that we aren't having people fall through the cracks. Too many times working with the VA and dealing with a lot of the veterans groups around Minnesota, and even probably some of the gentlemen that are in our audience here today, too many times stuff falls through the cracks that we can't correct. Well, this gives us a chance to correct some of those things that we said, oh, my goodness, we didn't cover that. We need to take care of that. So I encourage you to go ahead and pass this bill. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Donay, because of Representative Severson's exiting, I'm here today. So just for the record.
We wish Severson was here.
Mr. Chair, I think he's out of order.
Way out.
More seriously, I want to strengthen the bill, and there's a provision in here that I want to maybe ask House Research to comment on. It's on page 2 of the bill, but it's not really the text that's under consideration for today. If you will pick up on lines 2.7 through 2.9, and what we're looking at is here the description of the benefit, and it says, until such time as a spouse remarries or sells, transfers, or otherwise disposes of property. The question for House Research is, sometimes it's an estate planning tool. Someone who needs extra income may sell their home and retain a life estate interest in that property. And the way I read this, that would be constituting some kind of sale transfer of interest in property, which that person who owned the property and retained the life estate would still be the owner occupant of that property until such time that they died. I'm wondering if that language needs to be addressed to be able to accomplish what we're looking at here as well.
Mr. Deeble.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I don't know the answer to your question. We do have our tax team here, but I don't know that they would know the answer to that as well. It's more of a civil law issue. But if they want to venture a guess, I'd be happy to call on them. Otherwise, we can get an answer to you once we talk to our
Mr. Chair. Law experts.
Mr. Davis, do you have a comment on that?
To this point, to the O'Driscoll question, not only life estate, but maybe reverse mortgage, too?
Would you be in the question? Mr. Chair, under law, you are still the owner of property in a reverse mortgage. You're just simply drawing equity out of the property using a mortgage document or a mortgage tool on that. If you have a transfer with the retention of a life estate, you're actually putting together transfer documents but retaining a life estate, the ownership of the property for the remainder of your life.
Okay, thank you.
To the point, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't want to stop the progress of the bill, but I think that is something that we will be looking at some point in the future when the question arises. So if we get clarification of statutory or legislative intent on that, I think that would be helpful at some point in the process.
Are there any other testifiers? Seeing none, I have an amendment labeled A2. Who is offering this amendment?
That would be me, Mr. Chair.
Does everyone have a copy of this amendment? Representative Makewade, please tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this amendment would simply extend the $150,000 exemption that is given to the 100% disabled. Sorry, the 100% disabled have a $300,000 exemption. The $150,000 exemption for the 70% disabled would also extend to spouses. That's what this amendment would do.
Representative Vetmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for bringing that in. And we sat in my office not too long ago, just this morning, and I think what you would probably want to do is put it together as a separate bill and bring it forward. I would definitely want to hear that. So.
Representative Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, thank you so much for your help this morning and your advice, and same to Representative Davids. And so I would like to withdraw the amendment to later come as its own standalone bill.
Mr. Chair?
Chair, Representative Davids.
I know I'm out of order because I'm talking about an A2 amendment that's been withdrawn, but I would say that it could go standalone bill or when this bill gets to property tax division, it'll go to taxes, we'll put it at division. This amendment could also work if you can figure those things out beforehand. I mean, I think either approach works, but I think there's some good potential on this amendment. We should consider it further.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and that is something that you might want to consider, too, doing a double track, doing your own separate bill, and then looking at maybe amending it in the taxes.
Representative Makewade withdraws her amendment. Any other discussion on the bill? Representative Detmer, closing remarks.
Again, this is something we've been working on for years, I think after this, we had this bill in the tax bill, and we tweaked it a little bit now, and I think it's a better bill than what we had last session, and I hope we can go forward with it and provide the needed help that our families, our veteran families, have in the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion. House File 119 be referred to Committee on Taxes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 119 is amended and referred to Taxes. The next bill on the agenda is House File 232. Chair Detmer, would you like to move your bill before the committee and that it be referred to the Legacy Funding Finance Committee?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Again, I would move House File 232 and be referred to the Committee on Legacy.
Chair Detmer, would you please tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I've carried similar bills like this over the years, the 10 years that I've been in the legislature here, and the Veterans Rest Camp is a facility that I've worked with over the last 10 years, and we've been able to do some great improvements there, but I'm not going to get into that. We have two testifiers here that will be addressing this piece of legislation. Also part of this legislation would be the Bill
funds legacy grants for the Veterans Disabled Vets Camp and also Camp Legionville to update their facilities. So, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to introduce Loy Allness and Randy Tisdall. They would thank Chuck Gronquist. Is he going to be here too? Chuck Conquest is here too. But and Eric Allness is here too. So we have a good group here, and I know they're organized, and I'd like to turn it over to them.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Allness. I'm the president of Veterans Campground on Big Marine Lake. I myself am a military retiree and disabled veteran, so this place is dear to my heart. Veterans Rest Camp has been a past recipient of state funds, and we are grateful for the support. It's because of that support that the camp has expanded greatly in the past 7 years. We've gone from having a few thousand veterans and their families per year to over 14,000 last year. So that's how much has expanded. So because of that expansion, we reached out to the American Legion. We feel this is a great partnership to have some of the veterans in the state that are looking for a similar venue that we just cannot take in anymore, that Legionville, Camp Legionville, would be that perfect fit in central Minnesota. But Legionville, Camp Legionville, has a key facility, their dining facility, that needs a major renovation for us to go forward with having veterans, referring veterans and their families there. So the camp portion, I'm just going to break it down. We're asking for $500,000. $222,000 would be for the major renovation of the dining facility. And $278,000 would be to build a new welcome center at Veterans Campground. Because of the expansion, the original welcome center is located in an area set back where visitors, thousands of visitors, come in and bypass it because they can enter and turn off to three different roads. So this is a safety issue as well. This building, the Welcoming Center, would be also an interpretive center, and it would also be a storm shelter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next testifier, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Tisdall. I'm the state adjutant of Minnesota's American Legions and a retired U.S. Marine of 20 years. You know, they say it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it takes an entire community, in this case the state of Minnesota, to help welcome our veterans all the way back home. And this legislation would help in doing that. There's no doubt that outdoor activities and such as camping are premier here in Minnesota. Hunting, fishing, hiking, biking, all those things can be accomplished at either of these camps. And there's no argument, even today by our federal VA, that non-traditional forms of health care, both mental health care and otherwise, are beneficial to veterans. So in essence, camps like the Veterans Rest Camp and Legionville provide opportunities for our veterans to get those kind of great things taken care of. The VA now recognizes those. The Veterans Rest Camp and Legionville are both focused on service to our youth as well as to the veterans and their family. I'm going to talk a little bit about Legionville because I think you know a little bit about the Veterans Rest Camp from Mr. Chair. It's in his area, and I know you've passed some legislation in the past, and we're glad to hear that. We're very pleased to be partnering with the Veterans Rest Camp on this legislation. We know that no one person can do it all alone, nor one service organization can do it all alone. Veterans Rest Camp, I'd like to address Legionville. Legionville was the idea of a nun in the early 20s in St. Paul. She seen the need for a road cross school safety training and reached out to Earl Brown at that time. Earl Brown was a prominent Legionnaire and also connected with the Minnesota State Highway Patrol. Earl went right to work by talking to the folks in his Legion post. The next thing you know, they're talking about putting together a program. They brought it together at the department or state level of the American Legion, volunteers, and for the first few years, they provided road cross training, which was given. The classes were taught by the Highway Patrol, which they still are today, and they were provided at the state fairgrounds. A couple of years later, through the work of Earl Brown and others, the American Legion had land donated to them on the shores of North Long Lake, approximately 600 acres, just slightly over. And that land then was utilized for a training camp. Volunteers from Crosby, Ironton, Aiken, Brainerd, all around the Central Lakes area came together, and they built 11, a chow hall as well as 11 housing facilities for the kids up there. The barn stood for many years as a symbol of Legionville in central Minnesota. If you talk about Legionville up around Brainerd, they talk about the barn. But the barn had seen better days, and we knew that it had to be replaced. So we sought funding from different sources and basically ran into a roadblock during those years. Our posts, as everyone knows, are struggling just to keep their doors open. But we turned to our posts and asked, please, can you give? We need a new facility at Legionville. And they did. The post gave. It became the commander's, state commander's project for several years in a row. Through the kindness of their heart and their hard work, through bake sales, auctions, a little bit of everything, they gathered up enough money that we could start to break ground for a new building at Legionville. We reached out to Morton and we asked if they'd do something a little unorthodox. Would you work with us and allow volunteers to be the employees? We want to save some money. The building we want is looking at like $600,000. We were able to build that building, but through volunteers and people like Anderson's Windows and other places that volunteered the windows, they gave doors, we got drywall. Morton worked with all of us and those companies to assure that the plans were done the right way so that we could put this thing together. And they were very successful, and they did build that building. But now we need to take care of the chow hall. We serve 8 one-week sessions are held up there. The Highway Patrol teaches the classes, and the AAA provides the equipment as well as the synopsis program for the overview for the kids. We have a lot of things done during in-between scheduled times where we bring in disabled veterans in the fall for a deer hunt. The Minnesota American Legion Riders bring in their people, and they have a romp in the fall. We also have an entire state function where we bring in veterans and their families and members and non-members for an entire celebration from a Thursday through Sunday. It's called the Camperee at Legionville. And any veteran can come to this. And the 10 districts of the American Legion all take turns providing food, but that facility needs some help. It's aged. It's been around since the 30s. It needs a new roof. It needs a new sprinkling system. And so this money would help us do that. And we'd be good stewards of the money because we'd use it in the same fashion. We would ask whoever provides the work for us to work in conjunction with our volunteers and our skilled laborers that are members of our organization, as well as veterans that want to volunteer to help, and any companies that would help that make donations to the improvements at that facility. I think that the relationship between the Veterans Rest Camp and the American Legion Legionville is a great relationship. The American Legion Legionville Camp is always looking for different ways to utilize the camp. It's a meeting place for the Lake Association. The Civil Air Patrol holds meetings and training there. So it's never ending, the expansion of the services that we can provide at Legionville, as long as the primary focus remains for the kids in the road cross training. That's our primary focus there, but veterans and their families are a part of that. Thank you for listening to my testimony today.
Thank you. And we have another testifier. Can you please state your name for the record?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Eric Alness. I'm also recently retired from the Minnesota National Guard and currently working at Cargill, where one of my roles is veteran outreach, military reservist outreach. And I'm the 4th District VFW representative to the Veterans Campground of Big Marine Lake Board of Directors. So one thing I found, member of the Guard and now working at Cargill, is that Minnesota has a very large and dynamic veteran and military reservist community. And unlike a lot of other states where there are active duty bases where they can go and get some of those services, Minnesota really relies on places like Legion bill and the Veterans Campground, where veterans and military reservists can come together. And increasingly, we're finding that, was stated earlier, we've gone from 3,500 people a year at the Veterans Campground to over 16,000 in just a decade. So it really shows, just in that one microcosm, how much this is needed by our veteran community to make sure that they get the support with their families, with other volunteers, to help them get all the way home in this current environment. And just for example, they participate not only as campers or participants in veterans events, but also as volunteers where they can continue to give back to their city, community, and country. And just an example, this past weekend at the Veterans Campground, over 125 youth from the National Guard came in to enjoy ice fishing event and really participate with their families and come back together with their families. So these venues, these places really provide important venues for all these other organizations to come into place. So since Minnesota does not have an active duty base, these nonprofit camps really serve that function, an important function to make sure that these veterans, military reservists, feel part of a community and feel at home in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any more testifiers?
No, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Do we have some questions? Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question. I just would like to comment on the fact that I think this is definitely needed in these projects. The Legion Post 98, where I'm from in St. Paul Park, they've done some tremendous stuff at the Veterans Camp with local youth, and Gone Fishing was the event going up there, and I know it brings a lot of veterans together with youth and family, and it continues to be a big deal every year in our community. Also working with children with different disabilities or abilities and bringing veterans and youth together. And I just want to make another brief comment on the Legion bill. I had no prior knowledge of Legion bill to this, but I do every year as a previous mayor, I used to declare School Patrol Day and go up and work with School Patrol because they were the ones that would get up earlier and be responsible to get their fellow children to school safely. And to see something like this is, I think, just a great deal. So I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward to us. Thank you.
Representative Look.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Detmer and testifiers, I really appreciate the description that you provided. In particular, I want to comment about Legionville. It's in our Representative Poston's neck of the woods. Representative Heisman, if he was here, he'd probably want to say something too. But he did an excellent job of describing what they do there. Community, just a jewel of the community, but it also reaches out statewide. It's truly a regional and statewide asset that serves Minnesota well. So again, I just want to thank you, and an excellent job on describing. That's an example of what both the Veterans Rest Camp and Legionville do. And so we just got to make sure we stay ahead and keep those facilities up and operating.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I just wanted to comment. I am a past participant in Legionville, so I just wanted to thank you for doing this work to try to get this done. As someone that grew up in rural Minnesota, I know it was one of the few opportunities for kids in that area to get that extra attention on something that's really important to the whole community. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any further questions or discussion? Representative Detmer, closing.
Just quickly, again, thank you, and I think the testifiers here said it best. And again, Minnesota is becoming a state that's getting to be well known for how we take care of our veterans. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to refer House File 232 to Legacy. Thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevail, and House File 232 is referred to Legacy. You're better than that.
I don't know which seat is hotter, the one over there or this one. So, but here we go. Our last bill of today is next bill on the agenda is House File 261. Representative Driscoll, you're a member of the committee here. Would you like to move your bill before the committee and that be referred to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee?
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would like to move that House File 261 be referred after today's hearing to the Committee on Public Safety and Security.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, your bill is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that I bring every biennium for the last two, this being the third biennium, dealing with funding of de-escalation training. And a little bit of background about what the de-escalation training is. Many of the members of law enforcement and public safety receive training on special kinds of tactics for different kinds of interventions and to deal with different kinds of situations they might encounter as a part of their public safety duties. One area that has become an area that we've focused here on the state of Minnesota and have added additional funding to is that of de-escalation training as it relates to veterans. One of the things that may end up happening is a veteran who, as you've heard from previous testimony and testifiers, may not be all the way home, and that has several different meanings. And they may be suffering from PTSD or other kinds of issues and have flashbacks or other kinds of reintegration issues. And because of their training, because of their background, they have been trained in high-powered weapons and tactics, and a law enforcement officer who approaches a residence or approaches a situation, there may be a hostage situation or maybe other, really needs to know what's on the other side of that door. And that's what this training has done for us, is it's appropriated money to be able to allow our public safety officials, law enforcement, firefighters, and others who may come in contact with those situations to be able to have the skills and tactics necessary to be able to defuse those situations and have everybody go home happy at the end of the day to their families as a result of that. Our goal has always been to have 10% of law enforcement trained in this, but it's an always ongoing 10% because you have retirements, you have people who are promoted and maybe aren't in the field or out on the street, so to speak, and so we continually need to put the money in to the program. I was asked recently, well, why don't you just make this part of base spending? And I said, no, I like the opportunity to be able to go through every year and talk to members about it and talk to committees about it, just keep our eye focused on a different aspect of the way that public safety is delivered and another way that we can help members of our community. Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to turn over the conversation to Mr. Bill Miklas, who has been involved in providing that training, and he'll perhaps give us an update on the success of the training and the current state of affairs. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Miklas, would you address the committee and introduce yourself and your, for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Bill Miklas. I'm an associate director of the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. I served as a police officer for the city of Burnsville for 30 years, and where I specialize in instructing use of force skills and leading the department's SWAT team. The Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute is currently receiving funding for the state from the state legislature to deliver de-escalation training skills to Minnesota's community safety personnel to strengthen their skills when managing persons who are in crisis. I want to thank Representative O'Driscoll for sponsoring HF 261, and I'm asking your support for the bill, which will continue that funding. As you know, our de-escalation skills training began with a single objective of developing the skill level of community safety personnel when they interact with military veterans in crisis. Minnesota's armed service members, including National Guard and all branches of Armed Forces Reserves, have borne a heavy burden in the recent overseas conflicts. The burden for many of those returning has made reintegration to civilian life more difficult. It is estimated that approximately 10 to 20% of Minnesota's estimated 15,000 active Reserve service members continue to struggle with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, or both. Oftentimes, that places them in contact with law enforcement personnel, and they have opposing objectives at that point. Today, our de-escalation class, skills class for community service members has been updated to include teaching methods that will help manage incidents with persons dealing with certain mental illnesses or behavior disorders in addition to PTSD and TBI. As law enforcement officers get better at recognizing various types of mental illnesses and behavior disorders, along with the underlying conditions and causes, they can be better equipped to protect themselves and those involved without the need to use force. Our class participants learn communication skills, intervention strategies, situational assessment skills, the ability to assess illness-based causes of behavior from criminal-based causes of behavior, and measured responses that reduce the need for, or at least the level of, force needed to manage the situation while achieving lawful objectives. At first, attendance at our classes averaged 20 to 25 peace officers throughout the state of Minnesota, sometimes less. But as interest in this topic grew, class size increased. Now the average class size that we have is 40 participants plus, with many chiefs of police asking us to have their entire patrol divisions trained. Attendees now include police officers, sheriff's deputies, state troopers, state and county corrections officers, paramedics, EMTs, and conservation officers from our DNR. All have legitimate interests as first responders to develop stronger skills at de-escalation and de-escalating persons in crisis rather than using force to control them. As stated, our goal is to reach a tipping point where perhaps at least 30% of all the state's 10,500 licensed peace officers have been trained in this program. As the maps and numbers that you've been handed out demonstrate, we're just short of that goal and therefore request additional funding to reach that mark and perhaps go beyond that. We know that the number will always be a moving target as officers retire and new officers replace them. But we feel that training a minimum of 25% of the officer population will create a sustainability factor that will institutionalize these practices. I'd like to direct your attention to the maps and just to point out how it has been distributed, our training has been distributed throughout the state in addition to having input in the area of the metro area where the largest part of the law enforcement population exists as well. I want to close with a quick story. The city of Bloomington, that would be a suburb of Burnsville, asked us if they could train 120 of their people. We said we could if we spread the locations around and invited others, and we did. And before that training was even completed, their chief came up to me and told me about a story. One of their officers had responded to a call at the Mall of America. A person was causing a disturbance. This officer had been in our training, and again, one of the principles of our training is slow things down. They did that. They found the person. They worked with the Mall of America security, and in conjunction with them, slowed things down, talked more than they might have, and the officers admitted to the chiefs, this came out better because of that training. The way we would have handled it before this training was different. Not that it wouldn't have been legal, but it was different and it was a much happier outcome as a result of it. So those stories have, we've heard several of them over the couple of years that we've delivered in this training. We really believe that's important. I might also point out the list of training that I had at the beginning of my career, SWAT team training, use of force training, as Representative Driscoll mentioned. Those skills are important, but so are these skills. And the list that I read off to you are what is needed as well in a balanced effect for those officers. So I appreciate your listening. I'm willing to take questions if you have any.
I do have a question, and first of all, Mr. Mikulas, I've attended one of the courses that came to my community, and I think the county, the city, police, fire department, rescue people, they all were brought in and took this this course. Is there a fee to this course for the participants?
No, the fee is covered by the money provided by the legislature.
Okay, okay. Are there any other questions? Yes. Representative Pryor.
I have two questions. First of all, just to understand how this training works, is there overlap with training specifically talking about working with veterans returning to the community, the stand down, and the idea that it might be other people with mental illnesses that this training would also be serving?
Well, yes.
Mr. Mikulas?
Okay. Excuse me, Representative Chair and Representative Pryor. As I mentioned earlier, it started out in dealing with veterans only in crisis, and we realized that these techniques are important and valuable, and the training audience has broadened out to include more people in providing those skills to non-veterans as well. But it's important to be able to recognize if the cause of some of the problems that they're in crisis with might be involving their military experience, that's good to know for us, and now we have the ability to ask those questions in a much better way. Just providing a question about or an answer to one situation, the officer asked, what does your DD-214 say? And that's if you're familiar, and the person just stopped, and you know about that, and you know what that is, and that itself brought the temperature down. So, yes.
Representative Becker, and Pryor, I'm sorry.
Just another question. Another question I have, Representative O'Driscoll, is you mentioned that you're bringing this forward every 2 years. You're not going to Florida, right? You're not going to Florida?
No.
And
that's not my plan anyhow.
And is the $100,000, is that adequate to provide the training that we'd like to provide?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Sure. We have $100,000 per year in the biennium, so as we're looking to put together the 18-19 budget, we'll have $200,000, of which $100,000 is for the first year of the biennium and $100,000 for the second year. We actually upped that about 2 years ago from 50-50 to $100,000-$100,000. So we've recently increased the amount of funds, and maybe Mr. Mikulas can comment about the amount of funding and if it's adequate.
Okay.
We are able to deliver 24 classes of approximately, on the average, 35 people per class with that funding. And one of the ways that we are efficiently handling the time, because one day, 8 hours, is not an extremely long amount of time to be learning these skills. But what we have done is work over the lunch hour. We provide a box lunch, and then listen to presenters telling about the resources that are available in that local community where we are working. So for the cost of a box lunch, we capture another hour of their time, and that seems to be working out very well. But as the class numbers rise, our budget for lunches is being stretched. So that's the only issue.
Representative Pryor, any other question? Okay. You're fine?
Okay.
Becker, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I wanted to thank you. I think this is a great idea. But one question I had, I recently signed on to Representative Cornish's bill that would give quite a bit more money than this to increase the training budget to the post board. And I'm wondering, with the idea being to keep this something at the forefront, and I know Representative Cornish's bill talks specifically about crisis intervention and conflict management, but I also think de-escalation would fit into that. So has there been any discussion about bringing that together? I think, Representative Cornish's bill, my understanding is that funding would be ongoing, so you wouldn't have to come back every 2 years.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Finn Becker, that's probably one of the best questions that I've heard in a while on this topic. Because we have been bringing this back and forth from the legislature over the last number of years, we also talked originally about having money available for post-training so that we aren't just necessarily working with people who are in law enforcement right now, that we can back that up and put that as a part of the training. By keeping this money in there, it allows for more options in addition to what Representative Cornish is looking at bringing forward in his public safety bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckerfin, the bill that you're referring to is a reimbursement program. So this is a direct appropriation to the provider. So it would be a little different in, you'd have to work out the formula for pass-through grants to the local law enforcement, which then covers their training of their officers, whereas this is direct appropriation to the provider, and they wouldn't need to seek reimbursement through that program. So it's a little different, but they're providing the same. The idea is to provide additional training.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then to clarify, because my understanding is that Representative Cornish's bill would fund and also require that the training happen. So this bill would just provide the funding, so it would be available to those who might want it.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pickering, this could, I think this program could be expanded to meet the requirements of the mandated training in the Cornish bill, because they're touching on very similar topics, as you mentioned. And so it would be, I don't know what the financial implications are of paying the provider directly as opposed to reimbursing the locals who pay the provider. But in this case, they're not paying the provider, so they don't need to seek reimbursement under the Cornish bill anyways.
Thank you.
I guess that can be dealt with in other committees. So,
Chair, it's a good problem to have.
That is. Yes, it is. You're right. Mr. Neumeister, you had some comments?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. As I travel the various buildings of the Capitol, there is a bill that sometimes interests me. And if I have a few moments, I'd just like to make a comment on. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the basic question I had, one of your colleagues has already answered. The representative, I don't know your name, asked that the basis of the question that I would have testified about. I, just being around a long time, I think this is a very valuable program. But for me, if it's just different techniques and different issues and different ways of doing things can be applied not just for veterans with PTSD or emotional problems with veterans, but can also be in various aspects of our community. So one of the things I just encourage is maybe see an example of how they do their training, the vendor that's now doing it, and that they get reimbursement for. And to make sure that some of the techniques applied to it can be used generally, not just for veterans. One, it saves expense in the long run. And two, if there's more discussion in bringing this into the most of the post board. And as we all know, what's happened over the last year, there have been other issues of law enforcement in community relations. This is another aspect of that, because some of the people that around the country that have been shot and killed have been veterans, and that should not happen. And some of you have been, this is my 40th session, and for those folks who have been around a long time, the constant issue of mental illness in law enforcement still continues and permeates. So this is a positive step, and I want to apologize to you for coming in. I usually try to give a heads up to legislators, but
it seems to disappear.
You know. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Those were a couple words I just wanted to say.
Mr. Neumeister, do you go around putting newspaper articles in our mailboxes? That's someone different. Okay. I appreciate it. So I
don't
thought
know
it was
about
you.
I do give newspaper articles to not in people's boxes.
Okay.
Personal delivery.
Well, I give them to representatives. Just at the last committee, because a lot of people never knew who Rich Neumeister is. Yeah. I gave an article just for them to know who this character is.
Yeah. But I know
Michael, I know the curriculum has changed, and I think you're addressing some of the issues that Mr. Neumeister just brought up. Could you just briefly tell us a little about that, how the curriculum has changed? You're reaching out not just to the veterans, but to any person that law enforcement or these people might come in contact with.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and representatives, there's a couple of things that I want to point out based on what Mr. Neumeister said. Mental illness is coming forward, and that's why the interest in learning more about it has risen in the consciousness and awareness of law enforcement executives. So it's we're realizing that, and as well as the changes that he's making and referencing to the we talked about earlier, the curriculum changes reflect not only a need to learn skills, but a need to increase or change the culture of law enforcement to recognizing the importance of quickly getting some calls completed, but at other times it's more important to spend time longer than you would normally on an ordinary call to make sure that these calls get handled properly. And that's a cultural thing. It's it's we got to keep moving on to the next one, and I think that's changing. And Mr. Neumeister, reflected that.
Are there any other questions? Any other questions? Yes, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll and Mr. Miklas. Chief Potts will be glad to know that he is now a suburb of Burnsville.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers? Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 261 be referred to Public Safety, Security Policy, and Finance Committee. And all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, we have about 20 minutes left. We have about 20 minutes left, and we'll divide that up equally between the American Legion and the VFW. And first of all, committee members, we have a special guest with us today. Commissioner Shelliffel is with us. So, Commissioner, if you could just let people know, the committee, that who you are. And I like to say that when the commissioner is in his office, he's one of the few commissioners that do answer his telephone. So, appreciate having you here, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, my name is Randy Tesnall. I'm the state adjutant of Minnesota's American Legion, and I'll give you a brief overview from the 30,000-foot level down to the state level and into your communities at the post level. Hopefully, I can do that in 10 minutes. The organization was created in 1919 in France. A few doughboys got together with leadership, and they said, hey, we got to get something back in the United States put together. The VFW is already there, but you know what? There's a few things that we'd like to talk about as well. So they created what they called at the time the American Legion. It still is known as today the American Legion. It was ratified on U.S. soil later that year in the spring in April at the St. Louis Caucus. And the original Constitution was put together right here in Minneapolis in November of 1919 at the first National Convention of the organization. That along with several resolutions went on to Congress, and we became a congressionally chartered veterans service organization at that time. We're a wartime veterans service organization, the world's largest as well as the state's largest. Eligibility comes through just one day of honorable service during a wartime or recognized conflict by the organization. I say recognized conflict because members of the Korean War, what we call the Korean War era, are eligible for membership in the American Legion. They have to have honorable service, but just one day of honorable service during one of those periods of war. It does not have to be associated with a campaign. So those serving all their time stateside are eligible as long as they have one day of service during a declared or recognized period of war. We're built on four basic pillars: the benefits to our veterans and their families, children and youth, as you've heard strongly earlier today, the promoting of Americanism, and the promotion of a strong national defense for both active as well as guard and reserve. Our headquarters is in the Veterans Services Building here on the State Complex, And each year we elect a brand new state commander, five state area vice commanders, a historian, sergeant-at-arms, and chaplain. Three of our officers are elected every 3 years for continuity reasons. The adjutant, that's myself, serves as the executive director, is a full-time employee of the organization, and supervisor of staff. The judge advocate is a sitting lawyer and practicing and provides us with legal advice and referral onto other legal matters onto other lawyers as needed. And a treasurer is obviously a person that we make sure before they're elected they have a substantial background in finance. We have 10 districts in Minnesota. They pretty much parallel the legislative districts. Each of those districts has anywhere from 20 to 70 posts within their district. We have 545 posts across the state of Minnesota. The headquarters provides support to them and the 77,000 members of the organization. We put out the state's largest and longest-running monthly newspaper, serving over 100,000 veterans in their households. Our membership is only 77,000, but we find that the widows and widowers of veterans prefer to still get the Minnesota Legionnaire after the veteran in their household has passed away or left. So we're still at 100,000 on the Minnesota Legionnaire. Those of you that are veterans and members of our organization get it, and you know that we work real hard with Al Zidane, our editor, who's also a noted military historian, does a great job. We have 30 different programs, each with corresponding committees with anywhere from 3 to 40 members. And to each of those, we provide support from our headquarters in the form of mileage and per diem for the work that they do in our communities across the state. Many of them you're familiar with: Legion Baseball, Boys State, Junior Shooting Sports, DARE support programs for anti-drug support, Legionville Training Camp, as I discussed in detail earlier, Americanism, Scouting, Veterans Employment, Energy and Conservation, Legislation, the SAL, Pheasant Feed Program, it goes on and on. We have a Post-Development and Revitalization Committee that's been more active in recent years than ever before because of the difficulties that posts are having to stay open. One distinct thing that you need to realize, and that's the reason that I passed out along with why it's important to be a member and we're more than just a steak fry, is the Constitution, the Minnesota State Constitution of the American Legion. Nowhere in there will you find that we tell posts to buy a bar, to run a grill, to run a business. The organization knew back in 1919 that would not have anything to do with veterans, but it would make a good meeting place. Posts were allowed to make those decisions at the local community level, whether they wanted to buy a building, own real estate, run a bar, run a business, run a grill. Those are decisions made at the local level. The state has no oversight. American Legion, me and my six staff, and the state commander each year, we have no jurisdiction over anything to do with their business or property. And that comes in handy when it comes to Graham Shop. So when that becomes an issue, somebody's been served, something happens, there's a law issue, and they come after the post, we oftentimes break out the Constitution bylaws and show to the legal path that we're not a part of that process. We don't train or give advice on the running of a business. And I think you'd all agree, today to run a bit, in the old days it was great. You could run a bar, get a bunch of volunteers together, and they could make it happen. And they did, very successfully, and for many years, and still today, it serves somewhat as a place for them to come and get counseling and be able to talk to their peers. But in today's society, to run a business takes trained business professionals, and it's getting harder and harder for our posts to stay open. In closing, I just want to say that here at the headquarters, we're available to you at any time. If you have questions and concerns about veterans issues, veterans legislation, we'd be glad to weigh in on it. Our rehab committee meets regularly with the state and federal VA. They meet quite regularly with all the veterans' homes, as well as the directors of the veterans' medical facilities and the benefits shop there at the Henry Whipple Building. We have six full-time staff that are overseen by myself, one part-time, and we have a $1.3 million budget to provide support and services to those 77,000 members, run the Legion Magazine, Legionville, all the other committees. At this time, I'll open it for any questions that anyone might have.
Questions? Yes, Mr. Cranky.
Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, you might consider changing this from steak fry to fish fry on the advertisement?
Yes.
I see a lot more fish fries at the American Legion than I do steak fries, probably due to the cost of beef.
That was just a comment? Thank you? Okay. Well, committee, this is something I'm going to try to do. Is, you know, the Commanders Task Force has, I think, 9 or 10 different veterans organizations. We're going to try to bring each of them in here to just talk about what they do within the state of Minnesota. And I know in the American Legion, you know, I belong to both American Legion and VFW myself. And what I would like both organizations to do, because both organizations own property, is to what you can do to increase memberships of these two important organizations. You know, the World War II veteran community is not there like it was years ago, and now the Korean War, the Vietnam War. We have a lot of young veterans coming back after serving these men and women, and coming back to our communities. And what steps are you taking as an organization to really draw these people into these important organizations that we have in our communities that do so much for our communities?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to your point, Representative, we do more fish fries than steak fries. Mr. Chairman, to your question, I'm going to address it by talking about why we're smaller today than we are. Think about World War II. There were 16 million that served in the ranks during World War II. A little less during Korea, a lot less during Vietnam, a lot less during the Gulf War. And today, we can run bombing missions from Arizona halfway around the world with one person with a joystick sitting at a screen. Doesn't take as many to run a ship. So the numbers in the military have went down. If you look at the market penetration, sales term, it's remained pretty much the same for the American Legion from the early days to today. And it changes throughout the region. I'll use Florida and Georgia, for example. They have a hard time making double digits, 10%. Minnesota, we average about 30% of those that meet that eligibility requirement that I explained that are in the organization. So if today's military being much smaller and we maintain that same, if we don't increase that market penetration, then we're going to continue to get smaller.
Yeah.
What are we doing to reach out to the new veterans? We know that these veterans of this era are doers. They don't want to sit through a meeting. They don't want to, you know what, tell me I'd be here on Saturday with my tool belt, and I'll be here, and we'll build that ramp for that disabled vet. You tell me what time to be here and to do this, we'll go make that happen, we'll get her done. They don't want to sit through meetings. We realize that. And we're looking at how to make those changes. The American Legion specifically, as I mentioned, we've got over 30 programs. Maybe we're in areas that maybe we're too big. I don't know. Today's veteran doesn't want to get involved in a whole lot of things. So the organization knows that it's going to change. Actually, I sit on the National Marketing Commission, and we're looking at how that works, what it's going to look like in 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. As the number of veterans decreases, unless we increase that market penetration, we're going to have to learn how to work leaner.
What I'm going to do now, I'm going to bring the VFW up too. So just stay sitting there, because some of these questions that might come up might be for both. So Representative Pryor, I'm going to wait, and let's get the VFW up there. And we have about 10 minutes. So I'm trying to divide it up equally between the American Legion and VFW. Okay, please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Hesselgrave, Mr. Chair. Members of the Veterans Affairs Division. I'm here on a rescue mission. The two individuals who are supposed to be here are hardcore combat veterans, and they had an opportunity to get a VA hospital exam today. So I'm the former adjutant quartermaster for the Department of Minnesota VFW. I used to be Randy's counterpart. Again, I'm with the Veterans and Foreign Wars Department of Minnesota, VFW, and it's always hard to follow the American Legion. And, you know, as you know, the VFW has much the same problems as the American Legion has. But I'm going to tell you that the Veterans of Foreign Wars, a nonprofit membership-based organization of combat veterans, currently in the state of Minnesota, we have approximately 41,000 members and 220 posts. We have a headquarters office located in the Veterans Service Building, and we have four employees in that office. We also fund, and thank you to the state of Minnesota, we have a state appropriation which helps us keep the doors open at our VFW Claims Service office at the Henry Whipple Building at Fort Snelling. We also have four employees there. They are currently serving over 52,000 active powers of attorney, and that's funded by your grant and the dues of our members, the Veterans of Foreign Wars. This year, our main focus in the area of PTSD, military veteran mental suicide awareness, military sexual trauma, and veterans homelessness. We are concentrating on that effort, not only on the department level, but on the national level. We just recently completed our midwinter conference, where we spent most of our time with bringing in professional people to conduct seminars for our members or any members that or any veterans that wanted to attend. And we conducted a class in post-traumatic stress, military sexual trauma, and suicide awareness and prevention. We brought in professionals to conduct those classes. We also reached out to other veterans in the conference and to review their current benefits and entitlements by offering our claims director, who sat in a room and handled claims and benefits and entitlements from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon nonstop. We are working to educate our posts and members on all of these very serious issues through our publications and classes that we conduct at our district meetings and at our posts. Our VFW here in the state of Minnesota, we have 10 members of our legislative committee. One of them is with me, our 7th District Legislative Chairman, Tommy Johnson. And you expected Tom McLaughlin to be here, our state legislative chairman. These individuals handle legislative issues not only on the national and state levels, but also on the local levels. So we're constantly educating our post and our members on legislative issues. I came here on a rescue mission. We were fully fueled, fully armed, but we probably didn't have all the right ammunition. So I think rather than read off all of our purpose and what we do, because we do a heck of a lot, I'm going to make sure that all of you have a copy of our VFW story and a few other things in your mailbox. I again apologize for that. Again, I'm coming in here on a rescue mission. So with that, I open it to any questions that you might have about the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I consider ourselves a blue-collar organization, and we'll get down and dirty in any rice paddy or sandbox you want us to get down and dirty in, because we've been there and we've done that. Thank you.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Chairman Detman. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being here today and for the rescue mission. We appreciate it. I guess this question does apply to both, I think, organizations. You said specifically the American Legion, it's recognized conflict, and you're also talking about foreign service, combat service. And so the assumption is that this is both, it's ongoing, and that today we're still part of that?
Yes, testifiers. Take your turn.
Madam Representative, the Veterans of Foreign Wars has had people eligible through conflict or combat for the Veterans of Foreign Wars since 1899. There's been very few windows where we have not had somebody eligible. Obviously, to be eligible for our organization, you have to have overseas service. The only exception to that rule is during 9/11. There were a small squad of individuals that became eligible at JFK Airport and a couple other major airports during the 9/11 attacks. So, again, most of our people have served under hazardous conditions somewhere in the world other than the United States. Right? And you can look at that. In World War II, there were some what we call the American Defense Ribbon, people that were operating off the coast, submarine control and all other stuff, which are eligible for the VFW.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Was kind of curious, is there much duplication between the two organizations? Do you have people that belong to both, and if so, any idea how many?
Testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, there are. We encourage, if you're a member of one organization, you're eligible to join the other, please do. Become a member of as many as you can. I, unfortunately, can't be a member of the VFW because I never deployed during my full 20 years. I never once deployed into a hostile area and got a campaign ribbon or award. But, yes, to the other question, if I may, Chairman, to eligibility for the Legion, that window has been open since 1991. Cessation of conflict has not been declared closed since 1991. So, yes, the answer is we've been open since that period. But we do have some windows in the American Legion that of non-eligibility during our time. Yes.
Thank you. And yes.
Mr. Chair, Tommy Johnson. I am a member of the VFW. I served in a war zone, Korea, because we've never signed a peace treaty with Korea. The VFW considers service in Korea service in a war zone. I am not eligible for the Legion because I didn't serve during a time of war according to Legion guidelines. I would like to point out that service in a war zone does not necessarily mean you were in combat. I was a clerk in Korea, and I never saw combat, but the people that did like to get paid, too.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, I really, literally was a Remington Raider. I'm airborne qualified, and I jumped with a portable Remington typewriter.
All right.
I am a poster child of a Remington Raider.
Thank you for your service, all of you. And members, how many here have one or both of these service organizations in your community? Okay. Now, I'm not going to ask how many have gone and visited, but what I'm saying is get out there and visit these organizations. Most of them have a kitchen, too, and you can get some burger and fries and other refreshments and get to know some of the people in your community that are part of our community that are veterans. They're great organizations, and we're going to be having some of these other organizations coming in and from the Commanders Task Force just to talk about what they do in the state. And definitely Minnesota is a place, I think Minnesota is becoming a place to be if you're a veteran. And yes, another comment?
Yeah, Representative Detmer, members of the committee, I happen to belong to a VFW post that does not have a post home. But instead, we own and operate a 33-acre sports complex and community center. We have avoided the club room atmosphere. Representatives, if you ever stop by the post and my trucks are beers free.
Okay. With that, thank you for your presentation. This committee is adjourned.